Our meeting will come to order. We do not have a quorum quite yet, but members, I'd like you to take a look at a handout the department has provided in response to Representative Lucero's question about a chart or a matrix to show educational programs and funding information. And I believe if you serve on K-12 finance, you're also going to receive either this same handout or one similar. We have a quorum present, so I'll call the meeting officially to order, and I'll refer to the handout in just a moment. The clerk will note the roll, and a quorum is present. Representative Pearson, would you look at the minutes?
I move the minutes.
Representative Pearson moves the minutes to be adopted. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Now, back to the handout, non-traditional education programs. Has everyone found it? Because you have several handouts from the department. It's a landscape. So if you would look that over, and if you have questions later when the department is at the table, please ask them. But it is quite thorough, and you will notice on the front page there are programs that occur outside the core school day or year. On the second page, they occur during the school day, and that continues to the back side of that page. With that, members, we're going to begin today by hearing from the Department of Education and their update on regional centers. So, coming to the table, is Mr. Steve Dibb, Deputy Commissioner. Welcome, Mr. Dibb, to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Steve Dibb, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think what we have kind of a conglomerate of presentations to get today in here. If you want to start with the regional centers, we'll do that and give you an update as to where the regional centers are and today and where we hope it continues to expand and improve over the years ahead. The initial implementation of the regional centers was actually a federally funded initiative starting in 2012 with our approval of our NCLB flexibility waiver for our Title I schools in the state. And as you can see, that the goal at that time in the waiver was to really address the achievement gap between the various student groups in the state.
Excuse me, Mr. Dibb, but members, it's on page 9 of the PowerPoint that you saw the title to just moments ago, Accountability 2.0 and the World's Best Workforce, What Does It Mean? Page 9, and we're on slide 19. Thank you. Proceed, Mr. Dibble.
Thank you. With federal funding those first couple of years, we awarded a competitive grant to three regional sites. And it split the state into three areas that coincided with a balanced number of focus and priority schools as identified under our waiver. Like you said, they're fully federally funded and provided a staff that would provide support on-site to focus priority schools. We'll talk a little bit more about what they did on a day-to-day basis. We saw some early results that were very promising compared to the previous statewide system of support, as this is called, under federal guidance, where we saw great improvement with our focus in priority schools for the first couple of years of the regional centers. So the team was comprised of 5 to 6 individuals in each of those three regions. They provided technical assistance in the area of math instruction and reading instruction, also differentiated learning and programming for English learners and special education students. They also provided technical assistance to leadership teams in these schools on the science of implementation, implementing programs with fidelity, and continuous improvement planning, and in especially areas as needed. So when they would go into one of these regional focus priority schools, the first thing they would do is help the district or school establish what their current operational and performance status is through a root cause analysis of the school, then assist the district in planning strategic interventions in terms that's related to the data of their students, and making sure that they're on target with identifying what those gaps were and strategies to close those gaps. And then provide consultation, training, technical assistance to support the school district's implementation of those. So ongoing. And in those priority schools, these regional staff members would be in those schools at least weekly, providing this consultation and leadership to the leadership team of the school. In focus schools, it averaged out about once every 2 weeks that they would go and sit down with the leadership of the school, working on their improvement plans and strategies. And then monitoring the school's progress with implementation, provide support where necessary to modify the plan. So because of that ongoing week-to-week support, we saw a great movement in the schools and how they addressed the achievement gap, and those achievement gaps closed to the point where we had, as you saw in one of the previous slides, over 70% of those schools improving to a point of not only improving their status, some actually moved within 2 years to a celebration or reward status. And so there were some good success stories. So based on that, we were looking at how do we expand that statewide. Again, keeping in mind that only 800 out of the 2,000 schools in the state of Minnesota are even Title I schools. And then again, with a priority and focus, we're really just taking a look at the bottom 15% of schools in terms of scoring on their multiple measurement rating, which is the rating that all schools in the state are given as a result of their federal accountability assessments. So we want to take a look at how can we provide this type of support to a broader range of schools that were not Title I schools, but also non-Title I schools who are also in need of this type of support. Okay. And we went black.
Mr. Dibb, why don't we just continue with our handout until...
So again, what we wanted to do is expand the regional centers, looking a little bit more like what we had with the original federally funded, where we had teams of people going into schools and working with them. So in the last biennium, the Department of Education was allocated $1 million per year to establish additional regional centers. That went from 3 regional centers to 6 regional centers. Each of those regional centers just really with that level of funding were able to put together a center director in each of the 6 centers, as well as the support materials that we need to provide for our fiscal agent. In this case, you had 3 more of our fiscal partners came on board based through a competitive grant opportunity. And so as you can see, I don't have a handout with me, Madam Chair, but there's a map or the page that has 2 maps, one of the original 3 centers, and then a map of the 6 centers on the right-hand side.
So members, that's slide number 24. Excuse me, Mr. Dibb.
Thank you. No.
Slide 24.
Thank you. So again, and I'm just going to back up the slide before that, slide 23, really want to take a look at shifting from a centralized delivery system at the Department of Education. And for some of you committee members who are from greater Minnesota, many times your school districts are quite a distance from Roseville and find it difficult to drive the meetings and so forth on a regular basis. So how could we provide that support out to them in reading and math and English language learner and special education instruction without having them get into vehicles and drive to the department? And so we want to provide a service that was more equitable, more effective, and more efficient through this regional center delivery. And so we expanded from 3 to 6, each of those centers, 6 centers having a regional director, like I said, as well as the in-kind services that we need to provide for our fiscal partner. However, the 3 federal teams stayed working in those 3 general areas. This year, what we were looking at is expanding the regional centers to those things that the Department of Education is obligated to provide. So on slide 25, key questions that drive the work of the regional centers. So does MDE have an obligation to provide the services or support in terms of reading, math, and so forth? We've always had technical assistance provided reading and math through our specialists. But again, we have 1 math specialist at the department, 1 reading specialist, half-time social studies specialist, 1 science specialist, covering the entire state of Minnesota. Not a very efficient system when they are spending most of their time as windshield time and not providing technical support out in the field. So we were looking at a way of delivering that support in a more efficient manner. And if so, would this be efficiently, effectively, and equitably provided through a regional delivery system? Again, we really, from the regional center standpoint, want to provide support from border to border across the state. And so what the schools receive in the metro area, for instance, should be the same assistance that schools are able to realize in the northwest corner, northeast corner, southwest corner, and have those same opportunities. So below you see it's like an umbrella, Regional Centers of Excellence, on slide 26. And those are the programs that were rolled out initially in 2014-15. Again, continuing the statewide system of support. And then you'll notice some things that have come forth from legislation, like all-day kindergarten, the college career readiness, the post-secondary toolkit that goes to the post-secondary transition plans that were legislated last session for all students in the state of Minnesota. It's providing support to that. The Minnesota Early Indicator Response System, the MIR system, which is in place, teacher development evaluation to help districts and schools handle the teacher evaluation statute, and then providing support in English language development, parent engagement, and so forth. However, again, most of these were just delivered through a series of hit and miss type of workshops around the state. Again, it wasn't equitable. We had to use some funds to just provide several workshops in each of these areas. And so what we are looking at, and again, we're finding that was, it's okay, but it's also kind of the way the business is always done. Some workshops here and there, people drive to, really wasn't building the capacity of districts, as we heard from them, like our previous model.
Thank you, Mr. Dibb. I'm going to interrupt you there because I think you have 2 staff in the audience. Well, I know you do.
Absolutely.
And I would like them to come forward and give a few examples of the work that is done in any one of these areas. So please come forward and...
I would call Ann Clark down, who is currently transitioning from one of our regional partners in Rochester to actually overseeing the department's regional center structure as we move forward. Ann?
Welcome to our committee, Ms. Clark. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. I'm Ann Clark, and I'm currently the Southeast Metro Director of the Center of Excellence of Rochester, and as Mr. Dibb said, I will be transitioning to the program manager for regional centers. If we look at, I've been with the centers since the beginning of the statewide system of support. We have found great success in our teams that get to work intensively in schools. Our teams go in as working with the schools with the leadership teams and the principals as partners. We don't go in and say we're going to fix you and this is how you need to do it because everyone's situation is different. So it's that building the relationship, because just coming in and working with a school, the relationship is really important. So we go in, build relationships, work with those teams, and our goal is to build capacity and sustainability. So we have a certain amount of time to work with that team in the school, and as we build their capacity, then we have the opportunity to step back. And actually, one of the articles that you received that was out of the Star Tribune does a good example of sharing how that we step back and the school takes over, because it's a, our goal is that we work ourselves out of a job with that school. There's another school that will need our support, but that they are able to carry that on without our team there as support for them. So that article just shares the reporter's vision and when the reporter had an opportunity to go in and see what was happening in the schools.
Members, that's the April 21 article from the Star Tribune.
So we have found great success in that schools want to change. They want to do the best for their schools. And just 2 weeks ago, we have a new set of schools that we're working with after the new MMR came out. And a school that had been a little hesitant, you're letting someone come in and kind of see your dirty laundry, see the problems that are going on, and to work with you. And so she, it was her first time working with the leadership team. And as she talked about what we can do and what we can support, the teachers were getting excited, and as the principal saw the teachers getting excited, everyone did. And a teacher said, you know, we felt like we had our name put on this bad list, but actually we won the lottery because we have this support here to help us. We have somebody that's going to work with us, not just tell us what to do, but to help us learn and make us each one of us better. And that impact is on the students, because when we become better teachers, better leaders in our school, then that impacts student achievement, which we've seen with our past school that we've done. So that's really that's the model that we want to have, to be able to work with schools beyond focus and priority schools. They're continuous improvement schools. Some schools aren't focus and priority just because they're just over their line, or they have needs too and support that we'd like to be able to provide. We'd like to be able to provide schools that are non-title schools that also need support. But focus and priority schools are Title I schools in just that certain small percentage of schools that we can serve. And the reason it's a small number is because we want to go in and work intensively in those schools, and we provide coaching support that's specific to their school. We have exactly, we know, here's the kind of things where we'd like to see them go and the what. We go in and help them do the how. How do we implement, and how do we do that in a way that we can monitor that and see what's happening and watch the growth of our staff and watch the growth of our students. So it really is bringing data into that, and data analysis is a huge piece of what we do along with that. That's what we'd like to be able to do for other schools in the state.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. I'm wondering, is there any one of those areas in which schools have asked for help, assistance, that are listed on Mr. Dibb's PowerPoint?
Yes, we've been working with schools in all of those, you know, opportunities in those areas. A huge piece is the standards with English language arts implementation that they would like more, and someone to actually come, not just go to a workshop and learn about it, which actually there's one going on in Rochester right now with teams of schools, but somebody then, okay, we learn the information, and that's one piece, but training doesn't do it all. Need support if we're going back into our school to have someone come in and say, okay, where are you at? Let's look at your plan. Where do you need support? Where do you need specific professional development to your school and your staff? And what do they need? And different staff may need different things, so it's really differentiating. Just like we do for students in a classroom, we need to do that for the adults in the schools as well, because people come in with different levels of skill in different areas. And another area is the English language development and looking at the data, and that is a huge area that we are providing some support to that, but schools are asking for more.
Thank you very much. Do schools use their staff development time, Ms. Clark, for these meetings, this training, or is it before school, after school? Could you comment on that, please?
You know, it might be different things depending on the school. The trainings that we offer are usually during the day, and so they're using their staff development dollars to pay for a sub to come. We don't charge anything for the sessions. There's no charge to that. The materials that we provide them, there are no charges to that, any of that. But it still does cost them money, and they need to provide a substitute teacher for the teachers that come out.
Representative Yarusso has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, two questions. The first is, I can imagine a couple of different ways to interpret it, so could you tell me what you mean by building your capacity?
Ms. Clark.
Sure, building the capacity of staff members. There's a couple places that we do that. One is with leadership. We build leadership skills in teams. And so there is the principal at the school, but a principal, I've been a principal. You cannot do it alone. You need to build teacher leaders in your schools, and that's really important. So we're building the capacity of their leadership skills to go out, and we may teach them something, how to do something in a professional leadership team, and then they may go out to their professional learning communities, which are probably their team members, and they will teach it to them and how that they're going to implement something that might have to do with an evidence-based practice, different kinds of things like that. So we build capacity in the principals. We do coaching with principals and meeting with principals before leadership teams to teach them how does a leadership team really work well, and how do you work with your team to accomplish the things that your school needs.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And secondly, could you give us one specific example from one specific school of how you worked with a school on one of these things?
Ms. Clark.
I will tell you, Garlow Elementary, which is in the West St. Paul School District. Working with there, yes, they're in the article there as well. That was one of the schools that our team worked with. Really, the school advocate went in and worked with the leadership team and the principal to build the skills. They ended up with a leadership team that functioned well. They partnered with the principal at first to facilitate that leadership team. The principal then began facilitation. Then they began shared facilitation of what happened with the teacher leaders on that team. So the leaders did that. We had our reading specialists come in and teach and provide professional development around the reading and English language arts standards. The team learned how to, learned about that information. They learned facilitation skills from our English language arts specialists. They went to their professional learning teams. They taught the same process. How are we building, looking at our benchmarks for our grade level and building our assessments around that, building our lessons to make sure our students are meeting the English language arts standards at a rigorous level. So then the teachers from the professional learning team went to their classrooms, implemented those strategies within their classroom, brought back results from their students to their professional learning team. They talked about, here's what happened in my classroom, here's how students are performing. They were able to talk about that as team members. Here's how mine, wow, you got great results with that. What did you do in your classroom? Those results then, as how teams were doing, came back to the leadership team. They monitored that. Here's what's happening in our teams. The principal did walkthroughs to see, okay, if this is our reading language arts strategy. Our team members helped principals set up walkthroughs so that they could see what was happening in classrooms, and they monitored that data as to how well their strategy was being implemented at their leadership team meeting.
Ms. Clark, in regard to the standards implementation, and this is what I hear from teachers across the state, is, you know, we're standards-based, but they have felt like they haven't had that time to adapt and to adopt the standards, and of course we've gone through revisions. How about the benchmarks? I mean, what kind of emphasis do teachers want in explanation of how they cue in to the benchmarks of the standards, because that will be the basis for the testing? Mm-hmm. Ms. Clark.
Part of it is being able to look at it horizontally at my grade level. What are the expectations and where do I build that in? Another piece is looking at it vertically. Okay, this is what's expected at third grade. What is second grade doing and what is fourth grade doing? Because I might think I'm hitting it and then fourth at third grade. And then I look, really, when I talk to my second grade colleagues, that's what they're doing. I need to be able to up the ante. So that vertical discussion. And what it takes is time. Not time, just overtime, but purposeful time.
Collaborative time.
Yes, and collaborative time within teams, within schools, to take the time to look at what's going on and what the benchmarks are and exactly how we're measuring that on our team, and then to come back to those professional learning teams and have discussions, continued discussions weekly about what we're doing, where we're implementing it, and are we implementing it at the rigorous level that it's meant to be. So what does that benchmark mean, and have that discussion about what does that really mean for third grade?
Thank you. That's good to hear. It reminds me of my early days in teaching when you really follow that scope and sequence. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I guess, to both of the testifiers, I live in the Atwater Cosmos Grove City School District, which is the superintendent, Sherry Berdarius, is quoted here in the Star Tribune article. And ACGC went from a failing school to one of the top-rated schools in the state. And when I went in and conferred with them and asked what did they attribute this rise in success, they said the regional centers of excellence. So I appreciate that, you know, that type of work you're doing. If you have any particular comments on something that happened in ACGC that helped them to improve, I'd appreciate hearing that. One thing that they did feel was a very important component to their success is their four-day school week, which I mean they use that Monday where they don't have students to do some of the things that you're talking about. So I guess some of us are a little chagrined at the efforts to do away with four-day weeks, because it's about much more than just saving money. I don't know that that even enters into the component anymore with them. But your comments.
Ms. Clark.
Mr. Dibb. Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Ms. Berdarius is one of our champions for the regional centers at this point, but if you would talk to her, she would say again, as Ann talked about some of our schools when we first started working with, she was not real open and receptive to the fact that of the identification and didn't really know what these regional centers were about and so forth. But pretty short order, she realized that, hey, these are people are here to help. We're here to help them build their capacity again to do this work and to understand what student data was all about and how that affects our instruction. And she started seeing fundamental changes right away. So again, a lot of it has to do with fidelity. You know, you can have any sort of structure in your school and so forth, but if you're, you know, again, kind of to quote the old saying, if you keep doing what you're doing and expecting different results, it's not going to work. So she embraced that change. She embraced the fidelity of implementation. She got into the classrooms. A great leader will do that. She took her principal with her. They sat in classrooms, made observations, talked with teachers about their practice, and really started that conversation about what best practice in instruction looks like, and again, studying that data. We just actually received an email from Superintendent Broadhurst this morning, again wanting to know more about the upcoming renewal of the NCLB waiver and what can she do to help inform her staff. So, I mean, we've just seen a real change in the leadership. And I would just want to add a piece about the capacity. It really is, as Ms. Clark said, we use the phrase, we lead to leave, that when we leave that school, they have the capacity to continue this work on their own. They've built in their pieces of the continuous improvement process where they can continue operating at this high level even though we've stepped away. So we're not removing a crutch, but we're leaving them with all the skills, knowledge, and abilities that they need to be proficient. But again, it has to start with that need to change or want to change, and that's what we found in ACGC. Madam Chair.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment. I've been a teacher for many years with the Albert Lea Area Schools and had the opportunity to work with the Southeast Minnesota Cooperative fairly often, and I want to thank you for all that you provide, because it's been very valuable for our schools. You know, we've had, I've gone over there for training specifically on smart boards. It was excellent training. Also had some facilitators come over to our schools. This was back when the standards, before the standards we now have, but in helping facilitate for our districts and schools, organizing the standards into gold and pink and so on. But anyway, I've found that it's very helpful, and I wanted to thank you for all that you do for our schools.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I want to congratulate you on the work that you're doing. And I had a question, though, about data. You mentioned the use of data. What comprises the data that you, use to improve a school?
Ms. Clark.
We look at a wide variety of data. It isn't just the MCA data, because the MCA data comes at the end of the year. That's one piece of the data that we use. We also use student achievement data. So it depends on the school as well. What kinds of things are they using to monitor their data? They might be using, if you've heard of NWEA, which is a test that you take 3 times a year to monitor student achievement. Some schools use that. Some schools have their own benchmark or their own common assessments that they use at grade levels. So they're pulling that data in. They're using behavior data. They're using, because if students are acting out and they're out of the classroom, they're missing class. So is it our students that aren't doing well? Is it because they're being pulled out of the classroom? So that's another piece of data that they use. They're using perhaps if they do surveys with parents in the community, surveys with students and their staff to find out what's going on. So they use a wide variety of types of data, and then they take that and they do a root cause analysis to find out where are issues, and then really what is that issue. If our students are having this not doing well in English language arts on the MCA test or on something that we're doing here, or we're having an issue in behavior, they dig down. It's not just about, oh, we think it's this, so we're just going to try this. But it's really digging down deep to the root cause. What is that? And we teach them different strategies to use to find that root cause. Once they have a root cause, they make a hypothesis, and then they go through some next steps of what strategies might help meet that need. And so they do some different things, and it's a research-based strategy. So what has that research-based strategy been used for, and what is it said to be used? Is it in a school that's similar to ours, similar to our demographics, that has been shown that it will work? So we teach them many steps to go through, and processes is a lot of the things that we do. So they really come up with a good plan then that becomes their plan for implementing the strategy that they believe will work best for their school. So it's not just a gut feeling, but it's based on data and really digging down deep.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clark. This has been very good for us to hear of the work. I'm wondering, do you then provide a survey after your team has been in and try to get some immediate feedback so that you can improve, or you can provide different services, or at least find out how these are working?
Right, we have a program evaluation that we do that includes lots of different data again. So it's some survey data, it's achievement data of what's happening at our schools. So we try to find that information in many different ways. It's the amount of hours that we spent in that school. We have a system that we've developed, a database system, that helps us track our hours that we've spent in schools, what we were working on, how we spent our time, and who was all there, that we can use to look at data. So we look at our own data through that CSTAR system. About every 2 months we pull that and see how much time have we been spending in that school. There hasn't been a lot of hours in that school. Why is that? What do we need to do to help dig in deeper there, to help build that relationship so that we can help that school see the importance and buy into what we're doing? What do we need to do there? Or we have spent a lot of hours there. What results are we seeing from that time there? So there's a lot of different ways we can look at that data.
And Madam Chair, in the 12-13 school year that was quoted in an earlier slide that showed good growth, through that system we were able to track direct service to schools. And during that year, we saw 14,000 hours of direct service to school leadership and school schools to through the regional centers. And so again, we now are doing this face-to-face service rather than this mm-hmm. large broadcast, you know, to a big group of people coming, and you don't know how the implementation of that goes. So the 14,000 hours of straight time, and also track the number of miles that people yes. put on that year, which were substantial, and yet we could see actually comparative to that in C-STAR is the growth of each school. So again, we're able to measure, like you said, is it making a difference, and if not, we're spending all these hours. Let's dig a little deeper into that school and see if we can support them even more. So it's been a good data system.
And Ms. Clark, staff members, are they teachers on leave?
They may Ms. have Clark. Taken a leave from their district, possibly. Usually a district allows you to take 1 year or 2 years, so our teachers have had to decide and have actually from my team have all chosen to stay with the team, but they have been teachers and they come with, we hire experts in their field, so we are hiring very high level teachers that have had experience in their specialty area as well as in school improvement. They've been on their leadership teams at their school. So we really want people who can work well and are collaborators and have come from that experience.
And one last question, Ms. Clark. Are many of these schools participants in QCOMP?
Actually, quite a few of them are, at least in our area. It depends.
Mr. Dibb?
It depends on the area. I would say just because of the fact that we have over a third of the schools in the state in QCOMP, there's a fair number, particularly in the metro area, I would say a good share of the schools already. And I think this has been kind of the solidifying of all the work they put into QCOMP, and it probably didn't quite all gel, and all of a sudden they have this capacity to really take a look at their work. And we've had a number of the schools say, we thought we knew what we were doing with school improvement through that, but again, this ongoing coaching and data analysis really gelled everything for us. So
we've also had conversations about that on how to make sure everything's aligning. So really at MDE too, it's not just this is happening over here and this is happening in silos. It's really working to have cross-agency conversations about what's happening out there. So with QCOMP, the QCOMP plans, and with the school improvement plans that the schools do as a part of this, really having those conversations and making sure everyone's talking to each other. That's been actually a really good thing that has come out of this as well, I would say, for the department, is really breaking down those silos across departments.
Representative Ward, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was thinking somewhat the same thing you were in terms of who are these people who are doing this and where are they coming from. And as you described it, I'm seeing a really big change. This is just in terms of taking care of your people. Big change from being in the classroom. So what does, you're spending a lot of time in the car, you're spending a lot of time out in the region. What does a day, a week look like on your team? Are you going home every night? Are you? How does that work?
Right.
How are you taking care of your people?
Ms. Clark.
You know, it looks different for every person in every region. Our northern region has the whole, for the statewide system of support, has the entire northern region. They're spending, they have the most mileage, and they're spending nights in hotels to get there the night before so they can spend the day, or there might be a meeting at 9 a.m., in the morning or 8 o'clock, and how do you get there? We have some, even from the Southeast Metro team, we have people that live all over Southeast Minnesota and the metro area. One of our people lives in Owatonna, and she has a leadership team meeting in Robbinsdale at 7:30 a.m. So she's leaving her house very early, or once in a while will go and stay the night before. So it's a variety of things. They're very dedicated, and they figure out what is going to work for them.
Representative Ward?
I'm still wanting to just follow through a little bit more on when you go in and work.
Okay.
Are you doing a day
sure.
at a time?
You know, it
Ms. Clark?
Or what?
Mm-hmm. It depends. If you're traveling further, you're probably going there and staying for the day. People who are working in the metro area might get to 3 schools in 1 day because just the logistics are easier. It might be a leadership team one of the advocates has from 8 to 9:30, going and meeting with a principal at another school to do some coaching from 10 to 11:30, and possibly meeting with another advocate in the afternoon. Caribou becomes one of their office spaces because they'll go meet and collaborate about something that they're going to be doing together in another school. In the north, where they're traveling 4.5 hours to get to a school, they're probably going to stay there for a longer period of time and get that done in one day rather than moving around more often. So they're doing coaching, they're meeting leadership teams, they're meeting with principals to plan leadership teams. They're looking at their specialty areas. So if I'm an advocate, I may be the math specialist, but we're going to be doing something with English language arts. So I'll bring our specialist in from our team, and we'll meet with the principal or the leadership team to plan and find out exactly what the needs are. And we'll do that planning for something that's going to happen down the road, those kinds of things. So we'll bring in people. We have all of our experts, and we use each other very well, and bring in so that everybody gets the best of what they can receive.
Representative Urusso, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a comment, really. You had mentioned that buildings hire subs to cover people while they're doing this work during the day. And, of course, there's a cost for that, but there's also another difficulty that has gotten a bit of press lately, that we have a sub shortage in a number of areas in the state, both in some of our local schools and in some other parts of the state.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to compliment you on your great work. It's a little awkward here. But I just had a question. I'm so glad that you are doing surveying and looking at how you can continuously improve. And I'm just wondering if you could share with us one or two areas, you know, that you set up as goal areas to improve in the work of the regional centers of excellence.
Mr. Dibb.
As we evaluated those first couple of years through our federal centers, we asked the same question Representative Ward did: is, are we doing the right thing? Are we providing the resource they need? And so that first year, we actually, it was 11-12, we didn't have a good way of measuring things. But when after we developed the C-STAR, which is an online database that all the regional team members enter their daily activities into, we were able to start using that data to take a look at where we were not being efficient in. One of those was tracking the mileage, and were we spending too much time and windshield time, and that's where it may sound, if I'm going over to Duluth and spending a night in a hotel there, you think, well, they're staying in hotels and living off the high life. But that beats spending 5 hours of drive time again the next day to do that. So really readdressed how we were providing the support, and then again comparing to the success the school is having. I think through that we also did a lot of anecdotal evaluation with the regional staff members. One of the things we kept hearing was, these are really tough conversations to have with schools when we go in that first time and we start talking about, you know, we really want to dig down to root cause. And not everyone, because again, as Madam Chair said, these are educators coming from all over the state in different walks of life. And so once every month, we bring all the advocates in for 2 days. And they either work with our experts in the field, but we also brought them in and took them through the Courageous Conversations training. So now they're equipped to go in, and let's monitor that now through our notes in C-STAR, how those conversations are changing in the schools when our people are in there. So again, that there's a constant feedback loop. We have what we call in the statewide system of support a communication protocol, probably ad nauseum. It is many pages long, but they were very proud of the fact that if there was an issue in a school, that there was a response back to that school within 24 to 36 hours from the Department of Education in some way, shape, or form. So as we start seeing our communication protocol slipping and it was taking longer through our database again to get responses back, we sat down and problem solved that. So a lot of it was operational in nature. And then when we start seeing the results of the schools, you know, you can say, well, great, 7-8% of their priority schools, you know, improved enough to leave their designation. we would turn around and say, okay, what about the 22%? What are we not doing there that we need to do differently? And so, again, it was about that the database and using the data to really drive those decisions. We also have had employed the efforts of an external evaluator and an ongoing evaluation of the system in terms of how it works in comparison to other states. And that evaluation feedback is continuous, and that evaluation will continue as we move forward through the help of our federal partners. So again, it's really data-based in our decision-making and providing the support to those regional staff members. Like I said, they come in and it's 2 days immersed every month in working with our specialists in the Department of Ed, and then every time there's a new staff member hired, we send them through basically it's called Regional Center Boot Camp for a week, and they learn implementation science, courageous conversations, standards alignment, and they do come out their head spinning, but they thought the statement I remember is, I thought I was really good at my craft, but I'm even better now, and now I feel like I'm a master educator. And so again, it's responsiveness to the system, both anecdotally and also data driven.
Thank you. Thank you again, Ms. Clark. And Mr. Dibb, do you want to continue now with the PowerPoint on accountability backtrack to members? That would be the beginning of our handout.
All right. Thank you again, committee members, for that opportunity to share the successes of the regional centers under the direction of great staff people like Ann Clark and the director Greg Keith from the director Division of School Support, who oversees the regional centers.
And Mr. Keith, would you just wave so that members know you are in the audience and chose not to testify but to use your good staff, Ms. Clark. Thank you very much for being here. Go ahead, Mr. Dibb.
Thank you. As you know, in 2013 the World's Best Workforce legislation was passed, and really was a new concept of bringing a lot of the principles that we learned working through the regional centers to every school, and putting pieces into place for school continuous improvement throughout the state. So we want to take a couple look at a couple of pieces of the legislation. We'll go through very fast. We have online supports on the Department of Education website, a full web page on just the World's Best Workforce. So I'll hit these points very quickly. We want to share a little bit of statewide data. In many times the question is, okay, World's Best Workers, how are we doing on that as a state? And then we'll take a look at, again, the possibilities that districts have to align the work that they're doing. And so just like the support the schools received in the regional centers, this is now providing districts with a framework for district leadership versus the school leadership that we were working with before. As you know, the World's Best Workforce has 5 goals spanning the really pre-K-12 span, from having all students meet school readiness goals, the research-based third grade students achieving at grade level, closing the achievement gap, which is in alignment with our federal accountability waiver, having all students graduate from high school, which I think, again, we all say, yes, this is a worthy goal, and yet it continues to be that goal we keep chasing. And so we'll talk a little bit more about how the state is doing overall and the districts are doing. And then finally, in conversation more in the last couple of years, having all students attain college and career preparedness. What's it mean in terms of not just producing a student who has a diploma in their hand, but a diploma in their hand and are ready for the next step in their life? The result of legislation really is providing a framework for districts that is a statewide accountability system. Some key pieces: it's locally owned. You write your plan for you. It's developed with parent and community engagement. And this is a theme that's stressed throughout the legislation if you really unpack it, that involving the parents, involving the stakeholders, is critical to really understanding what's going on in a district. And again, many times that criticism that we hear from the field is, I don't know what my district is doing, there's misunderstandings because we don't know, everything's so secretive. So this is an opportunity for districts to open up and show their stakeholders what's going on in the district and tell their story of all the great work that's going on. And again, then we it's supported through by MDE with guidance and technical assistance, and we probably should have had a C-STAR of our own on this one starting back in July of 2013, because we have put in tens of thousands of hours of support to districts around the state. A couple of key pieces of that legislation. The school board is to adopt a plan, and it's an actual strategic action plan each year. Many times strategic plans are developed and they're 5-year plans or they're 10-year plans. This is a 1-year plan. What is you're doing this year to move the needle on student achievement? It has clearly defined locally developed student achievement goals and benchmarks. A lot of that data analysis we talked about earlier is just getting people to understand how to write accurate goals, realistic goals, and then how do you measure those goals. Evidence-based strategies. Again, are we doing what we've always done and hope to get better results? We're really understanding what the strategies are we're putting into place and what the impact on student learning is going to be. And again, to Madam Chair's comment about an articulated curriculum, are we teaching what's being tested? Is it what we deliver in the classroom, what we also measure them on in their assessments? And again, using the student achievement results to drive instruction. School boards will establish an advisory committee. That's that first step in that student or that stakeholder engagement. And notice that we're talking about school boards and school boards and school boards. And because of that language, we have really seen an uptick in the involvement of school boards in this conversation. It is not unusual for me every couple weeks to get a call from a school board member from a district saying, help me understand more about this worth-based workforce, because this is looking like something that's really going to move our district, but we need to know more about it. We've presented at the MSBA conferences. We've presented just strictly for school board members and on breakout sessions and ongoing conversations, because they are the ones responsible for the plan and for developing the committee, advisory committee, that again is going to reflect the diversity of the community they're in, make recommendations to the school board, on achievement, really getting that conversation started about what is student achievement, what are your goals for kids in district XYZ in terms of what they should learn and know. This is the Worthless Workforce legislation has been around for a number of years, but it was under another name, and it was called, basically we used to call it the PER report, or the Report on Curriculum Instruction and Assessment. And this is kind of reconstituting that annual report on the 5 goals of World's Best Workforce and how the district is addressing those. And they should publish this report annually. So that report right now should be on the website of all your districts, where you can go on there. It should be on the front page, and they link to that World's Best Workforce report or plan. And that is not a report they send to the Department of Education. That's for their stakeholders. That's theirs. Again, I encourage superintendents, use it as a communication tool with their stakeholders. The districts or school boards should have to hold an annual public meeting. I talked to a district the other day that they were actually going to have the Rotary Club in their community facilitate this meeting and really engage the community in that conversation. Periodically survey constituencies about the connection to the schools and level of satisfaction. And then the one thing that involves MDE in terms of reporting is, after they write that report about the previous year's work under the World's Best Workforce Plan, and they have a new plan already produced now for the current year, is to submit an electronic summary of the report to the commissioner. And those have been coming in all fall along, and that summary is just really, here are the 5 goals. What were your goals that you set under those? What were some of the strategies that you put into place? What are you going to do as you move into your next year? Really just a summary. That, as you know, then the commissioner will review over a course of 3 years, and after 3 years determine which districts are making progress on teaching and learning, which ones need more support. And that's where, again, our hope is that the regional centers can be at the forefront of providing that support for districts. Let's talk about 5 goals in statewide measurements. So the first one is have all students meet school readiness goals. And up to this point, we have had a school readiness study administered every year to just 5% of the population. But because it's been standardized in terms of process, it's a random sample that is done the same way every year, we are getting some results, and we see that the results ticking up into the mid-70s in terms of school readiness. However, it's, like I said, it's really limited in its scope. And so in 2013, the Department of Education, the Division of Early Learning, undertook a two-year pilot to increase the number of tools used and link the tools directly to early learning standards. So they took six nationally aligned assessments, and they have been piloted throughout districts and providing them technical assistance on how to do that. They're getting all the information data back this spring, and from that they'll do an alignment study and come up with at least three options for districts to do. And these will be optional assessments that they do, but at this point I would venture to say that if they are not already using one of those assessments, and many districts that have strong early learning programs are already conducting these assessments, and these assessments are not like an MCA assessment where it's one time shot. This is where a student comes in, and the teacher spends time during classroom time assessing the students on a list of skills, abilities, and knowledge that students have, and they continue that assessing them throughout the course of the year in the day-to-day instruction. So they're really building a profile, if you will, of that student's skills and abilities and how they align to the national early learning standards. And then that information can help us determine how prepared those students were coming into the school, but also passing that information on to our first grade teachers. Now, again, imagine a first grade teacher never having this type of data handed to them before, and all of a sudden, here comes all my first grade students, and here's all the information that we know about them, their skills and abilities in reading and math and numbers and so forth. And now I can take that information as a first grade teacher and adjust my instruction individually for those students.
Excuse me, Mr. Dibb.
Yes.
Representative Winkler, do you have a question that's relevant now?
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead and ask it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dibb, and maybe you're going to get to this, I'm just curious about substantively, what are they assessing? What are I think you said the skills, ability, and knowledge that we want kids to have coming into kindergarten under these rules? Because I've heard a lot about process, but not about what you actually want them to know or be able to do.
Mr.
Right. Thank you, Representative Winkler. The national early learning standards, first of all, are both a cognitive as well as a socio-emotional bank of standards. And so that assessment not only looks at their skills and knowledge around both letter and number identification, also their processing in terms of are they reading, and if they're reading to what level of mathematical processing can they do, as well as things like color recognition, and then again getting to the social emotional need in terms of their socialization with other students in society, in large groups and small groups. And those are all have been condensed into a series of small, what we call dipstick assessments throughout the course of the year that the teacher can accumulate that data. At any given time, they may not get that full profile of the student. I would think that at a certain point, as the students come in, we're going to want to take a look at some of those basic skills that they have in terms of number and letter recognition and use, and then moving from that to some of the social emotional pieces later in the school year. And again, I know that there is interest in having an early learning hearing at some time, and I would encourage at that conversation at that time to kind of dig in and unpack those standards a little bit more as Bobby Burnham or other members of our early learning division come and they can answer more detail and what those questions are. The standards are linked off the early learning website of the Department of Education. And again, this is a teacher-delivered ongoing assessment. So again, as you looked at our regional centers, one of the things we had in there, Madam Chair, was support for the all-day kindergarten, and that includes the assessment pieces as we move forward. Because this will virtually be available to all students, we'll not be dealing with a limited sample anymore at 5%, but because we have a very large population coming in, and again, we're not dealing with just half-day kindergarten, but full-day kindergarten, we should see some significant changes, whether it's going to stay, you know, consistent with the readiness counts we have now or not. But again, this is something, as we've done trainings and World's Best Workforce around the state, that that this is a need that they've expressed in those sessions, that they really need more information to be able to judge whether their students are ready for school or not. Under the third grade assessment, a lot of different ways to measure that from the state standpoint. We can take a look at our third grade comprehensive reading assessment, and 2013 in blue, 2014 in red. On the right hand side, we see growth, uptick growth in all of them, in all the student groups. And again, this is just one piece of data that we have, macro data for the state, but in a school district, you're going to be using other types of forms of data that Ms. Clark talked about in order to measure reading assessments. And really strong reading teachers and elementary, particularly elementary teachers versed in reading strategies have a cadre of assessments up their sleeve to measure kind of day-to-day progress on and reading, and then again being able to monitor that student. So when it comes to the MCA later on in the year, it shouldn't be a surprise how students are doing. And that's what we're, again, part of the work of the regional centers helping schools do. Again, third one, closing the achievement gap. Through the use of our multiple measurement rating, which was developed under our NCLB waiver, all schools get a multiple measurement rating, which includes their proficiency data, growth data, there's an achievement gap closure metric, and then graduation for schools that graduate students. There's also a focus rating, which measures the focus proficiency and the achievement gap rating. So again, we can measure how fast, and we set the goal in our waiver of closing the achievement gap in Minnesota by 50% by the year 2017. So that's the goal that all districts are working for. So how well are we closing that gap to reach that 50% mark by 2017? And right now, we're showing progress to get there. The next slide. The next slide talks specifically about some numbers. You can go through those on your own, but you see that if we take the first one, 75% of schools are on track in all student groups for all but one group in math. And again, when we talk about student groups, they're listed above. And when they're on track, it means if they continue at the rate that they are in terms of improving student proficiency, they will reach that 50% closure by 2017. Again, not knowing where we're going to be with that, and when we put that metric in and that goal in, you can see that we have strong numbers of districts that are on track to close that gap. And so again, it's another metric we use as we support schools, you know, to the point where we are sending out individual data to each district in terms of where they are with each student group and how many students they are actually missing off their being on track from. And so they may have a special education group that's not on track, but we can actually figure down to the student. You have 14 special education students who are not proficient. If they were proficient, you'd be on track. So now we need to accelerate even faster, knowing that the targets for the achievement gap closure is going to raise as well. We need to accelerate those student learning. So that's some data that we have on achievement gap. Graduation from high school, you'll see on the far right-hand side, we have the latest data we have is the 2014 graduation data coming out within the next several weeks, so watch for that. But last year we posted positive gains in graduation from high school, and this is has a lot to do with schools paying attention to getting every student through, looking at other ways to help students graduate, working through alternative programs, offering more concurrent enrollment type coursework, looking at providing better supports to English language learners and special education students. We've seen some improvement, and we hope that this can continue to uptick as we move forward.
Excuse me, Mr. Dibb, but Representative Seltzer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dibb, I'm just wondering, are some students counted in more than one group?
As you look on the bottom of your chart, Representative Seltzer, you have ELL students that are in that kind of that third from the bottom, and again, so that could also mean that they are of certain race. They could be Hispanic or Asian and also be an ELL student. Special education student, again, could also have a racial demographic. And the last one there is free and reduced price lunch. So again, depending on what that percentage is for a district, just was working with a district the other day that they have 83% of their students in the district are free and reduced lunch. So that pretty much encompasses the entire student body. So it will vary from school to school and district to district, but yes, they could be double counted. Actually, triple counted if they're also in special education.
Thank you, Mr. Dibb. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. And members, I think by looking at that last chart, you can see where what we're doing is working. Continue, Mr. Dibb.
The last goal is to have all students attain college and career preparedness. And that's a conversation, like I said, that's come up in the last couple of years, and it's been a robust conversation around the state and schools, and appreciate the conversation at legislative level as well. There are some metrics that we can use. Again, we're moving to an ACT test for all students this year, but up until this point, one of the things that we've been talking to school districts about in terms of indicators of college career readiness is a number of metrics that they do have. For instance, the ACT composite score by race and ethnicity in Minnesota last year compared to the national level. And again, you'll see that Minnesota, as we know, fares well. But again, just keep in mind the ACT stats that we use are for district or for states that only give more than 50% of their students the ACT test, and we're at about 70% already. So based on that, ACT does not, they've been working some numbers, and they don't believe that our achievement level on ACT, even when we go to all students, will change that dramatically. And again, there were 10 states in the last year that have all moved to ACT for all students, so we'll have good company in order to compare our data moving forward. But as you know, Minnesota's always been a strong ACT score. The thing that we're concerned about, again, is that achievement gap, because not all of our students groups, even the ones that are taking the ACT, are doing as well as the all-student or the white students. This is a conversation that I'm sure will be revisited many times over in the next couple of months, but concurrent enrollment, again, broken down by student group, and as part of our work in the department and regional centers, how do we provide supports to some of the student groups that have low participation in concurrent enrollment? What are some other options that we can have and provide for students in those particular areas? But as you can see, for the most part, there's been an increase in the number of students over the past several years in concurrent enrollment, and just having those classes under a student's belt prepares them more for that next level of life. Another indicator we use is the number of students taking the advanced placement. Advanced placement being a rigorous course that students take and then test out. And as you can see in Minnesota, in fact, the College Board has called Minnesota out in terms of the increase we've had in the number of advanced placement tests, thanks to generous funding that we received to help students take that exam. And you can see that we are up to 37,000 students, or tests, I should say, exams taken, not students, but the exams taken, because students can take more than one. And we've seen not only has that number gone up, but our average number of achievement levels continues to go up as well. So you'd think that as more students take it, achievement levels will go down, ours continue to go up. But again, having you think about the collective students that take advanced placement, concurrent enrollment, and strong ACT assessments, those are indicators of college preparedness and also career preparedness. And there's a lot of other work that can be done with that. Districts are asking how they can set their standard around that. They all have an ACT test. They may want to establish for the world's best workforce a district goal of all students taking the ACT will have a cutoff level of this, say, 18. And then we have so many students in 18 to 22 and so forth. So they can set their own goals on that from the district level.
Representative Yarusso has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we could back up to the graph you had about the ACT composite scores. If you notice that across the board, Minnesota scores are higher than the national, except for our Asian students. And this is an ongoing issue with looking at data by student groups in Minnesota, because Minnesota has a long history of taking in refugee groups. We've got one of the country's largest Hmong populations, and we've also got Karen immigrants and others. And the data, when you dig down into it and disaggregate it, data on Asian students bifurcates into it. It's a bimodal distribution. And so at some point, we really need to start looking for that group at that number in that way, instead of just lumping everybody into one category, because it doesn't really give us helpful information when it's grouped this way. And that might also be the case for a couple of other groups also. So at some point, we need to get better at looking at data.
Thank you, Representative Russo. I would agree, and that was a question that came up the other day at a Senate hearing as well. You can see that they still have a strong achievement in Minnesota. However, it is a changing demographic in the state. We met with the Council of Asian Pacific the other day, and 2012 we held a parent engagement forum. And at that time, there was a small group of Karen adults in Minnesota. I was surprised to find out the other day we were up to 10,000 refugees in the last 2-3 years now. And so this is a problem again. It's really a dichotomous problem because, like you said, lumping them under one heading is not necessarily representative of the needs of all those students. So thank you for pointing that out. And finally, just information on the World's Best Workforce. There is, we sent our mode of transportation for information is the superintendent's newsletter, which goes out every week. And we also have a website that you can link to with all the forms, the guidance, and the supports for districts. And then we've set up an email box, which is where the summaries are coming in to that questions or resources or complaints or whatever can come to that email box, and we'll respond to them. So I apologize for rushing through. I want to respect everyone's time here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your presentation was very thorough. And Representative Christensen has one last question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Dibb, piggybacking a little bit on Representative Yarusso's question, I think it might be useful to see information as far as those demographic groups in terms of what percentage are recent immigrants to this country. I don't know if you have that information. It could break down a graph like that, but I think that would be useful information for this committee in looking at the achievement here.
Mr. Dibb.
Yes, we can show what we have. Unfortunately, as again, particularly with immigrants, we do not always have a great record. Again, it's tracking from the districts. Some of the districts send us through their student accountability system. But when we go back to the regional center work and really helping those districts break down, you know, who are these students and what sort of supports, and just having them sit in the class with me, and understanding where they're at and trying to teach them just like I teach all my other students. Many of the times these new students come in without formal education for previous years. So again, we need to know where they're coming from and what their level is. So again, how do we assess students when they come in? But we can break that down through our enrollment data and provide that at a later date.
Thank you
again, Mr. Dibb. And I'd like to call to the table Darren Corti, the Assistant Commissioner from MDE, to explain the Special Education Task Force on caseload and rural assignment. Welcome, Mr. Corti. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Darren Corti. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. In that role, a couple of the areas that I oversee are special education and the rulemaking processes that the division has. So I'm here to talk to you about the Special Education Caseload and Rule Alignment Task Force and give you an update on the work of that task force. For those of you that are new to the committee, we'll step back to 2013 when this whole conversation started. During that session, there was a lot of conversations about the paperwork burdens that teachers take on, especially special education teachers. And as part of that conversation, it was recognized that you can't have a real complete conversation about paperwork without also talking about caseloads. So the 2013 legislature asked the Department of Education to put together a task force with 10 members, including school district reps, special education teachers, advocacy organizations, and parents. and develop recommendations for the appropriate numbers of students with disabilities that can be assigned to a teacher with and without paraprofessional support. And then the task force was also assigned to take a look at state rules that needed to be aligned with state statute over time. There had been some changes in statute and some conflicting rule that existed there, so the idea was to create some alignment. So, that task force was required to put together a report that was going to be submitted to the legislature on February 15th, 2014, making recommendations. So taking a look at the existing caseloads rule, which is 3525.2340, there's a number of factors which we take a look at to determine what a teacher's caseload can be. Some of those are the pupil's age, the percentage of the instructional day in which a student is receiving special instruction from a teacher, the student's disability type, and whether the program, whether there are support program assistance available, such as paraprofessionals. The dividing line is 50% under the current rule, so for school-age pupils receiving instruction for more than 50% of the day, the rule sets out a maximum number of pupils that can be assigned to a teacher based on the student's disability and whether program support assistance are available. For school-age pupils who receive instruction, special instruction for less than 50% of the day, it is left to the local school district's policy based on the amount of time and services required by the student's IEP plans or the individualized education plans. So during the interim between the 2013 and 2014 session, the task force was assembled and met and came up with a report and recommendations that were submitted to the legislature last session in February. And they recommended a number of things, but the major pieces were keeping the existing caseloads rule in place and modifying it as opposed to repealing it and rewriting it entirely. To modify the rule to clarify and give guide districts when determining a caseload policy for pupils receiving special education services for 60% or less of the instructional day, so that cutoff was moved from 50 to 60%. And then add a clause that provides that for children receiving special education services for 60% or more of the instructional day, to provide the option of lowering the number of students with high behavioral or mental health needs to ensure all students have the opportunity to receive a free and appropriate public education, which is required under the Federal Individuals Disability Education Act. Other recommendations included adding a definition of what caseload meant into the rule, amending the rule to align with federal setting requirements in IDEA, and providing consistency in the usage of the term paraprofessional. Further considering paper workloads and strategies to improve educator workload and due process effectiveness, and then, as we mentioned before, the rule and statute aligning. So as a result of that report, the 2014 legislature granted the Commissioner of Education to enter into an expedited rulemaking process to adopt the rule changes recommended by the Caseload and Rule Alignment Task Force. So that process began after session, and in July 21st, the initial draft rules were published in the state register, along with the notice of intent to adopt. On August 22nd, the public comment period ended, and while there weren't enough recommendations to hold an administrative hearing, there were a number of recommendations and comments that we received, which were reviewed and taken into consideration. And there were some changes that were made to the initial draft rules to reflect those changes. January 7th of this year, the Office of Administrative Hearings approved the proposed rules, and they were subsequently sent to the Secretary of State and the Governor's Office. The Governor kind of has the last say in this process on whether or not to approve or veto the rules. He hasn't made the decision yet. He has until February 26th to do so.
Excuse me, Mr. Corte.
I'm sorry, January 26th.
Representative Kreisha has a question. Oh, thank you. Proceed.
So moving on in the process, Madam Chair, once the Governor approves, the final rules and notice will be published in the State Register, which is typically 2 weeks later, and then the rules go into effect the day after they're published in the State Register. This is a little different than the general rulemaking process, which has an extra five working days after. When that's published, we'll provide an update on the rulemaking webpage. We also maintain a mailing list of folks who contact the department who are interested in being updated on this, so they'll be updated through the rulemaking mailing list as well. You'll have a final draft of the rules in your handouts. You know, reading them is a little bit different than reading a bill, so just to clarify, the subparts that are in that rule there, you know, they're not underlined, but those would be replacing existing subparts or adding new subparts to the rule. Where it says for text of subpart CMR, those will just means that those the existing rule will continue to stand as is there. As we mentioned before, the some of the larger additions were the definition of workload, the changing from the 50% to 60%, the ability to lower the number of lower the caseload based on the type of disability that a student might have, as well as some increased guidance for the local policy for students who are receiving less than 60% of their day in special education services. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Corte. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Corte, very good. Thank you for the information. One thing that I'd like to at least suggest is I notice in your slides, you do a good job of making the case of caseload, but you do have paperwork load in here. I would actually recommend that we take that out, because it's really not the paperwork, it's the caseload. And I think we nibble around the edges when we use the term reducing paperwork. So just a suggestion, just a thought.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Corte, you know, maybe I'm missing it somewhere, but regarding the caseloads, we have percentages. It says the rule sets a maximum number of pupils that can be assigned to a teacher based on the student's disability. Is there a number, a caseload number, that a special education teacher cannot surpass?
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, if you look on page 2 of the revisor's draft of the adopted rule there under 3525.230, you can see starting at line 2.6, it does set out the maximum number of school-age pupils that can be assigned to a teacher based on the disability that teacher has, and then the number of or the amount of time that student receives. So for students that have received 60% or more of the instructional day, there is a maximum number that's set out in the rule. For less than 60%, it still is based on local policy, local board adopted policy.
Members, this is a separate handout. It's a revisor text that you would find, and it's on that page 2 to which Mr. Corte was just referring for caseload. So if you're still searching, I think it's in your mix of handouts. And that's an important section of the rule to understand what goes on in our school system in regard to special education and caseload, and it's delineated there. The only change that they're making is noted in line 2.24 and continues on the top of page 3.
So,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Corte. So the number can vary depending on the disability factors and the teacher.
Mr. Carty.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, that's correct. For the more severe and labor-intensive, for maybe lack of a better word, disabilities, the number is lower than it would be for other disabilities. So you can see, for example, under subpart 4 there, deafblind students, students suffering from autism spectrum disorders, cognitive developmental disabilities, severe profound range, or severely multiply impaired, the caseload would be 3 for students who are receiving more than 60% of their time. But then you go all the way down to other disabilities with certain paraprofessionals, and you can get up to 10 or 12 as the caseload.
And members, that delineation also helps us understand the cost involved in special education because of the need for paraprofessionals. So this is one to understand when you have conversations with the teachers and with the school boards and school districts in the rising cost. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to disagree with Representative Kreisha that because caseload is, of course, the primary issue, but there is a secondary issue of the volume of paperwork per student that affects the ratio of time the teachers are spending on physically doing paperwork versus time they can spend with students. And so we have an opportunity to look at ways that we can reduce that volume of paperwork even without changing the number of students that a given teacher is dealing with.
And members, we will hear from Assistant Commissioner Montano just briefly. So she's going to go over the new online system update. That may raise some questions for clarification. Representative Kreisha, do you have a question again?
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Urusso, if I could just respond to that, because I agree with you in spirit. My challenge on that is, and you mentioned it, the online system, these schools are doing this with digital means. And I absolutely agree with you that we have to get to the heart of the matter of why they're doing the work. But I think what we got into confusion last session was by saying that we'll digitize this as opposed to doing it in paper, and we never really addressed the problem. You know, maybe we can change some boxes on the forms and that, but our real issue is conformity to all the accommodations and all the individual IEP plans and what's happening there in the legal aspect. And while you and I probably agree in spirit on this, I just don't want to get bogged down just by saying because we can change a couple boxes here or take a paper or two out of the report, we've accomplished that goal. We'll accomplish this goal when our teachers have more time with their students and less time sitting at their desk and not interacting with students. That's the point I'd like to make to that. And maybe have a response to that before I get into my next question.
Representative Moran, you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just going through looking at the transition and the behavior intervention planning, and we know a lot of times that students are put in special ed because of behavior problems, you know, maybe ADHD or some learning disability, to never transition out of special education. So can you just explain what is going to be done going forward to change that trend?
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, I'm not sure that these recommendations, get into the kind of detail of changing the way that special education students are taught. I think the goal of all IEPs is to serve the needs of that student, and in some cases, certainly transition out of special ed services is the ultimate goal. In other IEPs, that isn't the goal. So I would say that that's just kind of an ongoing goal of our special ed staff as well as staff in the districts to make sure that students are receiving the services that they need. And, you know, if those students are able to transition out of special ed services, then obviously that would be a goal of the IEP team to work toward.
Representative Moran.
Madam Chair, within this, has it ever... Was there any conversation about how we can it's a common practice to place children in special education classes, right? In a huge way because of behavior problems. So has there been any conversation at all about, because once you've been classified, especially it's really hard to move them beyond that. You know, even as they transition from elementary school into high school. So is there any conversation been given to, to minimize that initial IEP or initial case or initial conversation that because of behavior problems they need to be classified as a special ed student?
Mr. Cardi.
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, absolutely. I think one of the larger movements in education right now is interventions and ensuring that we can get to students before they become so discrepant in their performance that they, you know, qualify for special education services. We've seen that in some of the conversations that we had last semester on multi-tiered systems of support and response to intervention. particularly in when we're talking about behavioral programs. We have a program called Positive Behavioral Intervention Systems, which a number of districts in the state are utilizing and are seeing really great results in intervening in students' behavior before they reach that level of needing special education services. So absolutely, I think that's a goal that we're all working towards, is to reduce that identification, get to kids earlier before they require those services.
Thank you, Mr. Corte. And at this time, I'd like to move to Ms. Montano's presentation on the overview of legislation that focused on the online system. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jesse Montano, recently retired deputy commissioner, and am now working a couple days a week on special projects. So one of those special projects is the online system. In lieu of the time, I'm going to go quickly over the handout. Just quickly, the legislation that was passed last session required a customized system, not one that was developed. We didn't think we needed to reinvent the wheel. The system focuses on outcomes for students and wanted very much that we aligned accountability and compliance with the system. Required the commissioner to consult with a group of qualified experts. Of course, wanted to make sure that the system had all the data privacy requirements included. Address the language barriers that prevent many of our parents from becoming engaged in the IEP process. Naturally wanted the system to comply with federal requirements. And wanted a system that could interface with between districts, among districts, with the Department of Ed. As you know, right now, districts can't communicate with each other because every district has its own system. The legislation outlined timelines. The system must be available to districts in school year 15-16. In 15-16 to 17-18, districts may continue to use their own the systems they use now or begin using the system, but by the year 18-19, districts must use the statewide system. The commissioner established, it also requires that the commissioner establish a public internet web interface to provide information to educators, parents, and the legislation appropriated roughly $1.7 million for the system. A work group was put together. That work group included representatives that basically represented the different advocacy groups, PACER, ARC, district special ed directors, teachers, parents. The group was charged with two responsibilities: to review various IEP process and forms, identify the components that would be included in an electronic IEP system for Minnesota, and also to identify and define the components that would constitute a comprehensive system for Minnesota. The group reviewed IEP forms used in a number of states. We looked at North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the U.S. Office of Education. Two states provided a demonstration of their own electronic system for the group, Colorado and Maryland. MDE staff also had conference calls with Oklahoma and North Carolina, two states that were in the process of making major changes to their existing system when we're developing a new request for proposal. The work group provided feedback on various systems. The group identified the top 10 forms for inclusion in electronic system, and the group identified their vision for what a comprehensive system should include if it was indeed to simplify the IEP system, the communication within the IEP system amongst teachers and with parents. A request for proposal was developed jointly by staff at the department and MNIT. The proposal is published in the State Register December 31st. Proposals from vendors are due January 29th, 2015. And a committee of three staff from MDE and two from MNIT will review the proposals against a scoring rubric. I'm open for any questions. That's pretty much where we're at right now, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Montano. You did that in spectacular time. Representative Lucero has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But my question was related to the prior, so I'll defer to anybody else first.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This seems like a fairly ambitious undertaking to achieve in the timeline that you have available. At the beginning of the presentation, it said that it's going to be a customized system, and you want to have this in place for the 2015 school year, so you have roughly 8 months or less from the time that the RFP responses are due back. This suggests to me that if you're going to do it, it's probably going to have to be sort of an off-the-shelf software system that's going to do it. What's your level of confidence that under the dollar amount that you have, the timeline that you have, and the standards that you have, that you'll be able to actually do this in the timeline?
Ms. Montano.
Representative Winkler, Madam Chair, this is a new venture for us, so your question is a very good one. We have outlined in the proposal those components that the committee or the work group indicated would constitute a comprehensive system for Minnesota. I guess what we're going to see when we get those proposals is how many of those components that we outline they will be able to provide for us. Because, yes, you are correct, we are not looking for a vendor to develop a system from scratch. We are looking for vendors that already have a system in place and with some modifications be able to connect with our programs that we have, our technology programs that we already have in place. So obviously they're going to have to, you know, work very closely with our IT staff. So we will look to see how many of the components that we've outlined they will be able to provide for us, and then in modified version and then within the timelines that we've outlined.
Thanks.
Representative Lucero, is your question for Mr. Corte?
Madam Chair, no, it's not. It won't be for any person. It's more of a research question.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Peterson, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious to know if in your RFP to help streamline the process of reporting to both federal and state governments that the software programs, do they offer that type of ability?
Ms. Montano.
Representative Peterson, Madam Chair, the system that we've outlined does provide that option. Again, we'll see how much of the components that we've outlined we'll be able to get with the resources that we have available. But yes.
Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And so just a quick clarification. You said in the RFP you're looking to bring an existing vendor's product forward. That could be within this. I know there's three in Minnesota. Are you also looking at outstate? So there's a possibility we could have one of the three that comes out of Minnesota or someone from out of state that they would be selected for the RFP. Is that correct?
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, that is correct. We have seven vendors in Minnesota currently that provide such a system to districts. So the RFP, we could get proposals from Minnesota. We could get proposals from nationally that provide services to other states. Yes.
Representative Kreisha.
And so, and looking at your timeline, so one of those, let's just assume it's one of the seven in Minnesota that's selected, hypothetically. After the 18 timeline, the other six, their systems, as I understand, you could still use that in your school district, but you're absolutely required to go to the centralized one. Is that correct?
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, yes. I believe it was, 17-18 school mm-hmm. year?
Yes.
They are all required. If the goal is to streamline the system and allow districts to communicate amongst each other, then they would all have to be on the same system.
And it's 18-19, according to your PowerPoint.
Okay.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Montano. My question is, what's the plan for training special education instructors on this system that will be new for most or all of them? Do we have people that will be training these special education instructors? I've talked to a lot of special education instructors, and they're pretty happy and pleased with the systems they're using right now. So my question is, how are we going to accommodate the transition? Will there be helplines for problems with the new software? What's the plan for that?
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, within the RFP, there is a component in there that requires the vendor to provide assistance to districts. We will provide ample training. I can tell you that there were a number of members on this advisory committee, but the work group that we put together that basically said, you know, we have systems, why are you bothering? But when all was said and done and they looked at what could possibly be a system for Minnesota, their comment back to me was, if you build it, we will come gladly.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question actually is kind of sparked by Representative Cresha's comments and then also Representative Moran's comments from earlier kind of go along with it regarding if a student is classified or put into special education and then they move districts. With this new system in 2018-19 that they'll all have to have the same plan, will that mean, what will the reevaluation process be like, if any? And I bring this up because I know someone personally that they had an IEP and they were really struggling in a school district. They ended up moving school districts, had a completely new evaluation by that school district, and then ended up being quite successful. And so I'm wondering, but if their plan follows them, what if that would still be possible or how that will work?
Ms. Montano.
Madam Chair, this system will allow districts to share information amongst each other in a much more timely manner. I believe now it could take up to a month for a district to receive information on a student, but we would certainly hope that the receiving district would take a look at that IEP along with the parents and reevaluate where that student is given the opportunities in that particular district. But the system is designed to facilitate that communication process.
Thank you.
Are there further questions for Ms. Montano? Seeing none, Representative Lucero, you have a question of the
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back to the very first question I had last time and thank those who put this together. It's very helpful. It does look very comprehensive, and I appreciate that. Can I have, or the committee members, have an electronic version emailed up to them if that's an option?
Representative Lucero, this came from the department, from, I guess here she comes. Welcome. Please say your name
Thank
for the
you,
record
Madam
and
Chair, members
answer
of
the question.
Wayne Nguyen, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. This was put together by our government relations staff with help from our Career Technical College Division, and yes, we can electronically send this out to you.
Very
thank
good.
You very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one last question.
Yes, Representative Becerro.
Thank you. The world's best workforce, going back to that discussion, on slides, let's see here, on slides 9, 12, and 13, it has some different metrics in there regarding ACT, regarding graduation, et cetera. But it only goes back a few years, 2013, I think the slide 12 goes back to 2010. My question, Madam Chair, is more of a research again. Can we get more data? I'd like to see going back as far as data goes to the 60s. I want to put this in more context as to the graduation rates, et cetera, so I can see if our goal is to close that gap. I'd like to see what the history of that gap has been, the trend over the decades.
So just to clarify, Representative Lucero, you're looking at slides 12, 13, and what else?
13, 12, and 9 were the three that have data in them that show achievement gap-related data. I just want to go back further if the data exists so I can put it into greater context.
And we will we will let the department try to figure that out. I think in past years we've had some of those records, so maybe they can just be compiled because we have seen that information for a number of years, at least while I've served. Thank you very much, and thank you for your help. GOP members, watch for an email from Ms. Mayo in regard to our meeting that we didn't have today because Finance is having their meeting. So please pay attention to that so we can find a time to meet. Are there any other announcements to come before the committee? On Thursday, we will hear from the educational organizations, some traditional and some non-traditional, about proposals or policy ideas that they have for this session. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.